It is 9 a.m. in the West Coast, and it is 12 noon in the East Coast. It is 7 p.m. in Jerusalem, Israel. Today is Wednesday, July 22nd, 2015, and this is Orly Benny Davis, and this is The Impossible Truth. Today on BBS Radio, we are going to say happy birthday to Prince George on his second birthday from England. And we're going to salute the Prime Minister of Italy that is visiting Israel today in Jerusalem and the region. And we want to wish him all the best of luck. We're going to check with some other news that I collected for you to see what's the condition and how we're getting along to make this world better. We have a lot of information, a lot of things to do. I know that there are news in the media from all sort of things about what's going to happen, you know, what's happening also in the financial world and some discovery that they found. Maybe we'll touch base on this too. But let's start with the Prime Minister Renzi comments, and let's see what he said in Israel today afterwards.
The Italian Prime Minister has been addressing Parliament ahead of Italy's EU presidency next month. Matteo Renzi called for a change of course in Europe, saying that a common currency and austerity policies weren't enough in the face of rising unemployment and Euroscepticism. He said that when Italy takes over the presidency, he would outline a new programme for the next 3 years. In the next 1,000 days, the Italian government can defy the European Parliament, he said, in a positive and a proactive way, in order to improve the country's conditions, in order to allow Italy not to have an agenda dictated from elsewhere. So we could say that we are improving reforms, not because others asked for them, but because we are aware that we need them. He added that Europe needs to be united on immigration. Italy has previously said it needs more support in dealing with boat refugees and a large number of migrants arriving from Africa. Renzi also said that Europe's economic policies had failed to produce growth and must change. Italy now has a youth unemployment rate of more than 40%.
All right. It was just a soundbite on what's the situation in Italy. And as I said, Prime Minister Matteo Renzi spoke today at the Israeli Parliament, and he was mentioning a few notes about the common denomination that we have between the Israeli and the Italian economy. We are really, really familiar with the Italian culture because the Italian had the fortune and the capacity to influence the rest of the world with their take on the culture level. They are incredible as far as going to the art and the history that they're beholding. And they continue to be a powerful force for the fashion industry, for the arts, to manufacturing of all sorts. So they actually apply and evolve since they are since the Roman Empire was. So what happened now, once they're on the ground in Israel, they spoke to the Prime Minister of Israel and talked about working a collaboration. Now, remember, technological-wise, Italy is very advanced. They are really, really up to the task with so many innovation, and they are really incredible. And more of that, they have a way of being that is very they perfect their method of application. It means that when they do stuff, they do it really for good. It's like from their fashion industry, you can see the difference between the Chinese and the Italian. It's different, but also in the mechanism of electricity of any sort of hand kind. When a human interact, they are perfecting it. So I think that the collaboration between Israel, that is more innovative, it's like let's go get them and also have a great idea on, startup nation, with the meticulous way of the Italian role, about their being, it can be a really, really a winning proposition. So I believe that we can see in the real future incredible force in Europe, ignited by Italian collaboration, but of course with Israeli. And you know, he said today something very cute, which said, you know, nobody can boycott Israel, because everybody was talking about the boycott. I didn't give it really a thought, because it was ridiculous. You can boycott yourself, because when you boycott Israel, you boycott, you know, your chip on the telephone, your microphone, your anything around you is part of Israeli nation, you know, manufacturing. So it's really ridiculous. It's like saying, I'm not going to wear a Chinese T-shirt in the future. It's like, right, how can you do that? So let's stop with nonsense in the world, and let's stop wasting so much money on it, because I've been consuming. The hater consume a lot, and consume also financial good. And it's about time we stop sponsoring all those activity of nonsense. So if Europe wants to start coming to the plate, and as they say, they have to change course. They have to change course. And what happened is they are trying to crunch down on the financial expenditure of the countries. And we have another soundbite that talk about the financial expenditure, and we're going to listen to it as soon as we can, because it's amazing. It's amazing to see how we have in the world, you know, the European debt crisis, how we can visualize it, how we can really see it and explain it. There's somebody who actually understands it. So let's see if we can get the European debt crisis on for you, so we can understand better what's going on.
The European debt crisis. Visualized. What is the European debt crisis? It's the failure of the euro, the currency that ties together 17 European countries in an intimate but flawed manner. Over the past 3 years, Greece, Portugal, Ireland, Italy, and Spain have all teetered on the brink of financial collapse, threatening to bring down the entire continent and the rest of the world. How did it happen? Uniting Europe. For most of Europe's history, it's been at war with itself. And countries at war with each other tend to do less business together. Europe was always a continent of trade barriers, tariffs, and different currencies. Doing business across borders was difficult. You needed to pay a fee to exchange currencies. And you needed to pay a tariff fee to buy and sell to companies in other countries. That tended to stifle economic growth. Then came World War II, which devastated Europe. Because the situation was so dire, the fastest way to rebuild Europe was to begin to remove these barriers. Steel and coal tariffs came down, so that a steel mill in one country could sell to a builder in another. This gave the survivors an idea, a unified Europe, a union across the continent that would end all future wars. Countries began to band together toward this goal, bringing down trade barriers, lowering the cost of doing business. One of the last barriers to fall was the Berlin Wall. With a united Germany, Europe was ready. 27 countries signed the Maastricht Treaty and created the European Union. This made doing business across borders easier, but there was still one major obstacle, the different currencies. A decade later, they had won. The euro launched on January 1st, 1999. Countries adopting the euro, called the euro area, discontinued their own currencies. They also discontinued their own monetary policies, giving control to the newly formed European Central Bank, commonly referred to as the ECB. The euro area now had one unified monetary policy, but it still had many different fiscal policies. A key reason for the current debt crisis. Monetary policy versus fiscal policy. You see, it's important to understand the difference between monetary policy and fiscal policy. Monetary policy controls the money supply, literally how much money there is in the economy and what the interest rates are for borrowing money. Fiscal policy controls how much money a government collects in taxes and how much it spends. The government can only spend as much as it collects in taxes. Anything above that amount, it has to borrow. This is called deficit spending. Before the euro, countries like Greece not only had to pay high interest rates to borrow, but they could only borrow so much. Lenders weren't comfortable lending them too much money. But now that they were part of the euro area's new united monetary policy, the amount they could borrow skyrocketed. Smaller countries suddenly had access to credit like never before. Greece and other countries, which previously could only borrow at rates around 18%, could now borrow for the same low rate as Germany. How? Germany's credit card. You see, joining the euro area is a lot like sharing a credit card. Germany's credit card. Lenders now believe that if Greece was unable to repay its loans, Germany and the other big economies of Europe would step in and repay them because they were now bound by a common currency. With a new abundance of cheap credit, Greece and other European countries were able to adjust their fiscal policies and increase spending to previously impossible levels. Some countries embarked on huge deficit spending programs, primarily for politicians to get elected. They made promises such as more jobs and generous pensions, all of it paid for with the new money they could now borrow. The governments of Greece, Portugal, and Italy accumulated huge debts. However, they were able to repay these debts with more borrowed money. As long as the borrowing continued, so did the spending and the unbalanced fiscal policies. In Ireland and Spain, cheap credit fueled enormous housing bubbles, just as it did in the United States. Credit flowed, debt accumulated, and the economies of Europe became tightly intertwined. Companies began opening factories and offices across Europe. German banks lending to French companies, French banks lending to Spanish companies, and so on and so forth. This made doing business incredibly efficient, while at the same time tying together the collective fate of the euro area. Things continued this way as long as credit was available, and credit was available until 2008. Spurred by a collapse in the U.S. housing market, a credit crisis swept the globe, bringing borrowing to a halt everywhere. Suddenly, the Greek economy couldn't function. It couldn't borrow money to pay for all the new jobs and benefits it created. It couldn't borrow the new money it needed to pay its old debts. This was a problem for Greece, but because of the unified monetary policy, it was also a problem for all of Europe. Much of Europe had been on a spending spree and borrowed more money than it could ever repay. But the problem is, somebody has to pick up the tab, or else every country in the euro area will suffer. Since the countries that ran up the bill couldn't repay, everyone looked to Germany. Austerity measures. As the biggest and strongest economy in Europe, Germany reluctantly agreed to help bail out the debtor countries. In other words, Germany agreed to repay the bill, but only if the debtor countries agreed to implement strict austerity measures to ensure that it would never happen again. Austerity measures meant sucking it up, cutting spending, borrowing less, and paying back more debt. This sounds like a simple solution, right? It's not. First of all, nobody wants austerity. Austerity means cutting government spending, and since the government is by far the biggest spender in any economy, when the government cuts spending, it cuts the earnings of many of its citizens. People lose jobs, they get angry, they riot in the streets. And austerity also doesn't automatically balance a country's budget. You see, the government collects taxes based on people's earnings. So when earnings are reduced, the government collects less in taxes. They still can't pay down their debts. The pain is so bad that it's almost politically impossible to accomplish. On top of that, there are huge cultural differences within the euro area. Extreme cultural differences. Germany is very financially responsible. Ever since the terrible hyperinflation the country experienced after World War I, it's been extremely inflation-averse and incredibly careful about spending and borrowing. In general, Germans work hard, expect little in the line of state benefits, and meticulously pay all of their taxes. Many Greeks, on the other hand, enjoy generous state benefits and don't pay taxes. Greece has a terrible problem. It has never collected the majority of the taxes it imposes on its citizens. And it's always been this way. Joining the euro just amplified it. The German view is that doesn't work. If you want our money, you need our morals. As the debtor countries headed towards default, the whole continent of Europe was in danger. Even though the economies of the debtor countries are relatively small, they posed a huge threat because the European financial system is so interconnected, precisely because of the euro. Remember, the debtor countries borrowed money from banks, investors, and other governments throughout Europe. As the debtor countries get closer to default, everyone who lent them money becomes weaker, and everyone who lent those lenders money also becomes weaker, and so on and so forth. A problem in one country could reverberate across the whole continent.
Exactly. So this is Orly Benny Davis with The Impossible Truth. Today is our day with the Italian music, and we were trying to make sense out of the European crisis. As they say, they're all interconnected. Once they have one coin, and everybody has to have the same fiscal responsibility. But the truth of the matter is that if you don't produce, if you don't make sales, or you cannot pay taxes, or if you cheat on your taxes, you don't pay the government. The government doesn't have money to spend, and that's when it has to borrow to cover the expenditure of a government. Or in case the poor, the people are poor and the unemployment is big, they need to finance those people in poverty, and less taxes in, less money, and they still have to borrow, making them a liability for the rest of the Eurozone. However, the Eurozone has to decide on a different course, as the Prime Minister Renzi said. They need to start planning on massive commercial impact to the area, because they've been keeping up on the same rate and the same mode. They actually unite, but they never unite their ways. No wonder England is going to have a debate about joining or not, disengaging from the European Union, because the vision was never completed. If you want to have a vision of unity, it means that you have to work as one. The financial system cannot be individually set for every country, and it cannot be put one time you work on one in one country, and then for the rest we are joined forces. So make sense out of it when you unite. You cannot join your coin, but not join your economic effort. It means that you are playing with a half a stack. Trust in yourself. Do the real thing. You help Greece. It means that you trust in yourself. You got Italy. Italy is reaching out to the rest of the world. It means that they are planning to be aggressive. It means that they're going to generate some kind of income. It's going to be better. So let them lead in some form. We have much more to listen to, and I know that if we can listen to some Italian music of Marcella Bella, you know, Io Domani, I Am Tomorrow, you know, let's listen to this. Maybe we can get some inspiration from some Italian music for the rest of the European Union that needs some loving and care. All right, and we are back. Marcella Bella, she's really beautiful, and she sings incredibly, and her passionate message is always heard. You know, it's really hard to listen when you forget how passionate the Italians are. You know, people don't realize what the difference between culture are is the difference how you take stuff. You know, in America, you learn to be rational. You keep your emotion to yourself and you keep on going because we cannot sweat it. You know, as Mr. Ventura used to say, we don't have time to bleed. Yeah, we have to keep on going. But the Italian, you know, they break your heart because they really have all their guts into it. So I wanted to introduce you to one of the most, you know, celebrated writer of our generation, Oriana Fallaci, that we lost her not long ago. But her interview in English is really a good example of what we really see in the difference between Italian and an American or in the Western culture. But it's only a part of it, so please bear with me. If we would like, we'll keep it to the next show. We'll get another part of it. But let's listen to it.
Oriana Fallaci, journalist, war correspondent, and author, died last week in her hometown of Florence, Italy. She was 77. She had suffered from cancer for many years. She is perhaps one of the most provocative interviewers of her generation or any generation whose fame reached its peak in the 1970s. Her conversation with political leaders, including Henry Kissinger and Ayatollah Khamenei, were at the times confrontational but always revealing. The child of socialists, she had contempt for authority and once wrote, "I have always looked at disobedience towards the oppressive as the only way to use the miracle of having been born." In the 1990s, she became increasingly reclusive, dividing her time between New York City and Florence. She returned to the public scene following the September 11, 2001 attacks with writings critical of Islam. Her book, The Rage and the Pride, drew accusations of inciting hatred against Muslims. She appeared on this program several times. Here is a look at some of those conversations. Why fiction rather than journalism to say what you want to say about war, relationships, power?
Right. Well, thank you for this question. Because, you see, when I say that journalism was for me like a narrow jacket, something in which I felt uncomfortable, I meant that when you write an article, a reportage, you have to stay within the limits of what has happened, what has been said. I mean, you must be very rigorous in reporting without inventing, without distorting, without manipulating, which was very good in it. But the better I was in being so rigorously faithful to events, the more I felt like writing handcuffed, you know? Yeah. You cannot move, you cannot open your arms, you cannot
what
see,
can't
say
you
more
do?
Concepts, for instance, or to what literature does, it universalizes the truth. People can recognize in that story. Do you know how many times I have found people that say to me, the character of that book is me. I found a woman, 87 years old, the grandmother, who said to me, Alekos, it's me. Alekos is the character of a man, the other novel, another novel of mine. I found the carpenter, 40 years old, who said to me, the child of I am the child of a letter to a child never born.
So you believe that Tolstoy has more to say about Napoleon and Russia than all the historians do. And you believe that Robert Penn Warren can say more about Huey Long than Huey Long's biographer can say.
I would say this, that we have understood much better the Napoleon campaign in Russia and what happened in Russia at that time and what General Kutuzov did to chase Napoleon through War and Peace of Tolstoy rather than through the history book that, by the way, a few people read.
Yeah, but some would say about your journalism that you were always, in a sense, by your editing, painting the picture as you saw it. So it filtered through your own imaginative process. You weren't putting people in their mouth. You weren't putting words in their mouth, were choosing what words to include and, more importantly, what context
true.
And what words
this
to leave out.
True. This is not true. These are my enemies saying, you know, people like me have a lot of friends,
no,
a lot of enemies.
This yourself.
No. It has been misinterpreted. No. I would never. The proof is that the fact my interviews were very long and I had to fight each time with the newspapers to which I gave them to run them completely. And they were so long because I did not want to cut what was said. Because if you cut a phrase, or if you cut a concept, you give it distortedly. Of course, I mean, if I go to interview Khomeini, I don't go as the best of friends of Khomeini. I mean, I'm ready for the worst. If I go to see Gaddafi, yes, I go as an enemy. Oh, yes. But, I mean...
You go as an enemy, as an adversary,
as an adversary to
Gaddafi,
yes.
You go prepared for combat.
Yes, to a bastard, yes, I would go. So I shouldn't say that.
That's all right. Yeah, but let me just stay with that, because I want to come back to the book. But just... You go to those interviews prepared for combat. You go looking for what?
I don't go prepared for combat. By the way, I did go because I don't make interviews since a long, long time. That belongs to the past. I don't make them. I don't have any need, any curiosity. I don't feel compelled to make interviews. They really belong to a remote past.
Okay.
But I went, no. I went to write a portrait. Or to write about an event.
And in writing a portrait or writing an event, in a sense, you define through the interview the portrait that you saw and what you thought was relevant and not relevant in the whole
process.
You're
doing the same with me now.
Of course I am.
Because the moment you approach a certain question rather than others, you give an image of me rather than another one.
How
it's your show.
Don't you ever forget it.
And don't you ever forget it was my show when I was making those interviews.
What is it about war? This is a question they always ask of you. Yeah. Why war is it so fascinating? And what is it that so appeals to you?
You're not saying that I like war.
Not that
you're
you like war, but that,
that
you
I mean,
like...
It's obvious I hate war.
You like the qualities of human emotion you see on display.
Listen, because like one of the characters of Inshallah says, the one I call the professor.
Do you have that easily there?
All right, we finished the first part of Jan Palachi interview with Charlie Rose. It's incredible. You can find it on YouTube. They're talking about her books and what's her perception, how she likes to write free of constraint. And that's a way of writing. And she wrote one of the incredible, cool book that I had to learn, Una lettera, un bambino mai nato, a letter to a baby never born. That's a part of the students, in Italy that you have to learn, and it's amazing. So let's go on, get some music, and then we keep on going, you know, checking out about, you know, on the universe and Europe today. All right, that was Renata Zero with Magari. Magari, it's the, I wish. That's Magari in Italian. Perfect. Renata Zero is a really great philosopher, and once you start listening to his music, you understand how deep he is into every concept of living. So he's very strong, you know, bold, but he's really, really deep. Anyway, we're running always, you know, behind the news and what's happening, and we want to turn the events of history and see what really is happening on the ground. Remember last week, the G5+1 signed an agreement with Iran, and all the world is actually in uproar about it. But the UN did confirm and sign it on. And now everybody, all the pressure is on the U.S. Congress not to approve it, which will make it bogus, because if America sign it with other party, it's their responsibility to ratify it, to say that it's a bad deal. Of course it's a bad deal, but you signed it with Iran, the enemy. You didn't sign it with your best friend. So they're not going to give you candies and cake after that and ice cream. So all this, uproar and... I'm really, really critics about it, because when you talk about your enemy, you shouldn't use the public platform to do so, because it's better in the back. They need to know that there is another option. They need to know that there is always the option of military work on the table, and they should, you know, it's like leaving the gun on the table for them to understand that they came to play. We trust them as far as their words and action goes. After that, anybody has the right to act. So we wanted to touch base with, I'm sure that many in my part of the world will say why you are not against it and everything. I've been around too long. You know, it's I know deals are signed that you can mess up any deal. If they want to mess up with you, they will. So what's the point of saying, making all this roar? Stop wasting time on the air. Use it to tell me how you're going to make this world better. That's why I don't agree with so many people that are shouting, screaming, to stop. How can you stop them? Or you stop them blank, or you work around it. Now, work around it, you need all the parties. Now, let's listen to somebody who we are trying to neglect to listen to, and this is Vladimir Putin. And Charlie Rose had an interview with him, and I want you to put it in the context of Europe, okay? Because Iran is influenced by the Russian, and the Chinese are influenced by the Russian. So please don't underestimate them. And just remember who told you so, Orly Benny Davis on BBS Radio, The Impossible Truth. So let's listen to Vladimir Putin.
Russia's President Vladimir Putin today blamed NATO ambitions to expand and the United States for fanning the flames of conflict in Ukraine. He did that in an international economic conference held in St. Petersburg. Part of the program featured an interview with Putin by PBS's own Charlie Rose.
And it's
seated in front of an audience of business people, political leaders, and journalists, the Russian president blamed the West for the conflict in Ukraine.
And help us understand, as you see it, where are we, how do we get there, and where do we go from here?
Why is there a crisis in Ukraine? I was quite confident that after the bipolar system went into oblivion after the collapse of the Soviet Union, certain Western partners of ours, particularly the United States, were in a kind of euphoria. And instead of trying to create a new situation, good neighborly partner relations, they started to explore new, free geopolitical spaces, well, free in their view. And that's why we were witnessing the expansion of NATO eastward.
I spoke to Charlie Rose immediately following his question and answer session with President Putin. Charlie, you pressed him about what he thinks Ukraine needs to do to defuse the situation. What did he say?
Well, he said they need to talk to the people. The people in Kiev need to talk to the separatists. That's not a new idea from him. He has always said that they need to have, you know, real conversation between the separatists and, you know, I mean, I think he obviously feels some affinity. And I raised the question whether, you know, were they helping the situation by supplying arms to the separatists, by, in some cases, the engagement of Russian soldiers and other weapons, I mean, other connections that Russia has to this. And I think Vladimir Putin, because of all of his experiences, you know, has a real fear about NATO on his borders. He's always had that. They had that with respect to Georgia and with respect to Ukraine. I think he probably worries that if a government in Ukraine was leaning east, it might, I mean, leaning to the west, it might one more time entertain the idea of NATO membership, which he really, really, that's probably the thing that he dislikes the most. I think the headline from this, he really believes that the United States and Russia should be talking, that they ought to be having a dialogue about Ukraine and other issues.
And what did he say about that? You asked him about the increasing tension and the relationship between the West and Russia. What did he say about that?
Most of his animus is towards the government in Kiev. As you know, in previous times, he has said that he thinks that the demonstration that overthrew the president of Ukraine, who fled to Russia, was a sponsored in part by the United States and the West, the USCIA. I think that most people believe that Russia, because of its, it has regained some of its military strength, and they do rattle the saber a bit, it wants to be a player. They want to be respected, which I raised with him, and he, in a sense, said, well, we are respected. Everybody wants to be respected. You know, but there's deep within him the sense that, you know, after the collapse in 91, that Russia wants to regain its status as a big-time player in the world.
Would you say that being respected or not being respected is a new concern, is a new posture on his part?
The fact that he did say it the way he did suggests that he thinks about it. And I think that pride for him and for other people, I mean, you know, Russia was a superpower. And then with the collapse of the Soviet Union, all of a sudden they were not a superpower. In fact, their economy was in terrible shape, and they had a whole range of cataclysmic changes in their economy and state ownership, and all kinds of oligarchs came forward. And Russia has been, you know, trying to recapture some of its global presence. He cares about borders, he cares about respect, and he cares about conversation. I mean, he wants to be talked to. He wants to be considered a primary player.
Charlie Rose talking to us from St. Petersburg, the site of this economic summit. Charlie, thank you, and travel safely.
Thank you, Judy.
All right, and we are back. This is Orly Benny Davis with The Impossible Truth. This is Wednesday, our Wednesday goes with Italian music, but it's also about the European situation and how everything is going out of control sometimes there, and what they're going to do about it. Now, we have a factor. We have Russian that is like the outside player. We are not doing anything to connect with them. We are letting it be. And for some reason we think that it's going to be okay to keep them out of the loop. They have the Chinese on their thumb, and they supply the Iranian. And they are very, very strong and powerful in the region, and still they are being undermined. I know Matt. I know my love is, you know, my heart is always with God. And once I know that God exists, and as we say always, there is a God and it's not us. We cannot play God. We don't dismiss any creature. We don't say that this part of the world doesn't deserve a part on the game. Especially when you're so powerful, you need to make it a good power. And as you heard me, this was last month, and nobody actually replied to him. You know, we have a conversation between death. Now that we have all this incredible race for the presidency, we have Donald Trump that is bullying his way around, punching and huffing and bad-mouthing everybody who moves. Now, of course, he's the most powerful American and is gonna kick everybody. But the truth of the matter is diplomacy needs, you know, to be like a ballerina. Like, you need to have the art of a grace and the kindness and the heart of a lion to incredibly understand and come about. And we are evolving. We're evolving. You know, I don't like this standing up and saying, you know, this guy is doing something to me. It's a childish attitude, and I have a problem with that. My idea of talking is evolving around accomplishment. You accomplish a deal with Iran. Let's give it the time, okay? Writing, sometimes, you know, whatever is written, it doesn't reflect whatever it is, for the good and for the bad. So maybe, you know, if they want to come to play, they want McDonald's, for God's sake. Give them McDonald's. Let's start with thinking what's happening. You know, we have, I heard a half of the good news today that Libya is on the verge, of course, after they bob each other up this last few days, they are on the verge of coming to an agreement. That's the UK ambassador said about the situation in Libya. It means that the immigrants to Europe is going to start flowing, will stop. We're going to start calming down the situation. It means that we can start recovering and helping them recover. Of course, they have a lot of resources, and you know, the management of it, these resources will be dealt with in some form. I know England is in the play, United Nations is in the play, who else is in the play? I'm not sure, but America needs to pay attention to what's happening in Libya right now. So if the UK is planning to, you know, to take under the wings the fight for ISIS right now, because she's empowering it, she's empowering their soldier, they are helping and they're going after it. Of course, being in Iran and opening, you know, by the end of the year, the embassy in Iran, again, reopening it, starting to understanding, means that we start going back to business. The world is starting to move. That stagnation of the 2 years of talks reflected on everybody. And we are not sure how gross it's going to become if we're not going to let it be. I have a situation that can reflect it. You know, when you want to grow, you need to let go. Whatever is done is done. And sure enough, Iran is no silly boys. You know, they understand that they're playing with the tough guy here, and all the world around her is not going to sit and do nothing. So let's give respect to the world. And Iran is not that great. She caught herself in a very, very big, big trouble. So I think that I'm sure that the agreement is going to work for the best of humankind at the end of the day, because we still have the power. Nothing, you know, we never got this out, but we need to roll. We need to stop stagnating everything. This is a world. This is a world. Anyway, it's almost time, guys. It's been wonderful always talking to you, because I'm trying to see the situation together with you. I'm trying to analyze it, and I'm trying to understand what it is. And I want to remind you all, we're going to have a talk show on Wednesday on Europe. We're going to have it every time. It's going to be at 7 p.m. Jerusalem time, and it's 12 noon Eastern time. On Monday, we're going to have it on 10 a.m. West Coast, 1 p.m. East Coast, and 8 p.m. Jerusalem time. On Sunday, we're going to have an early rising at 7 a.m. in the West Coast, which means that it's going to be 10 a.m. In the East Coast, and it's going to be 5 p.m. In Jerusalem time. On Sunday, we're talking about the Israeli side music, Israeli music, and on Sunday is the day of fasting in Israel on the destruction of the temple. So be prepared to have me talking to you about the temple and what actually it means in the realm of faith, understanding, and godliness, and God, and living with God among us, and what's the creation of this. Because right now we're finishing 7 days of, you know, of preparing. It's a run out. It's like something we prepare your soul to be real with the redemption side of it. It's like you ask for God for forgiveness. Because once you've been taken the house of God, it means that, you know, God is not seeing worthy. And coming back after 2,000 years, the Jewish people found a way maybe to have the grace of God. And, you know, Matteo Renzi, the Prime Minister of Italy, today said in his incredible speech at the Knesset, and you should listen to it. And I want to listen to it all in Italian, because he's a really eloquent man, and he's a spirited young man that, you know, worth following. Matteo Renzi says, you guys don't have only, the Jewish people, don't have only the right to exist. You have the duty to exist, because you are the children of Abraham. You're the children of Abraham that gave us, you know, you give us the way of to exist with God with us. This is somebody who understands God in a way that, you know, I never heard a leader in the free world talking before. He understands the duty of the Jewish people among all the other nations and all the other religions. That's why Italy stands with Israel today. It's not because it wants to punch or say Iranian are not good. Because Iranian, you know, Italy and Iran have a lot of things in common. I know the Iranian are travel to Italy, and nobody stopped them. But the idea is that they are seeing the complex, they're seeing the universe, how it's evolved, and how you can understand the role of the Jewish people. And the Holy Land is a place that, you know, all religions should come and pray before God. So, as I said, this is a space where I let God be and I let you understand my understanding of God. So we can all be better and we can turn this page on history and make sure that, you know, Brotherhood of Men comes around and become wonderful. Now, I want to salute you all, and I want to leave you with my favorite music of Maxima. Is from Ukraine. It's from Croatia. Sorry, guys, I'm sorry. Maxima Vrika is fantastic. He's a young, good, great-looking guy that played the piano like there is no tomorrow, and I'm enchanted by him. And he's giving us, you know, we're finishing with Wonderland. But I want to tell you that I love you. I'm here for you. Email me, call me, orlyusa@aol.com. But we're going to have email for this show because we deserve it. But on Facebook, you know, BBS Radio, The Impossible Truth. I would love you to give us some comments and join us anytime on Skype that you want. And for all you, God bless you all. Take care, and we'll talk to you Sunday morning, 7 a.m. West Coast. Goodbye. Take care.